Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Yeah, a bit more light would be nice, so I can also see those of you sitting in the back. I like to see the faces of people when I speak to you. Thank you. That's lovely, Anna. That's enough. So here we are again in the middle, or pretty much in the middle of this retreat, and you have done very well so far, as I can see. And I like when, like, a longer retreat like this one, 10 days retreat, comes to a point like this, I usually make a reminder, as I did this afternoon with the metta guidance. When we do these retreats, these vipassana retreats, we are very easily get into a practice that can almost dry out our hearts if we are not careful. It's all about mindfulness and being present and awareness, and sometimes I mean definitely it's very important, it's crucial to do this practice, crucial in terms of developing on the path, but sometimes we forget, and sometimes we even get out of contact with our hearts. And in my own experience, I know that it is very important to be in contact with the heart. Like, having been living monastic life for quite a number of years and really focusing on mindfulness, awareness practice, being present, and that is all right and important. But the other part is also important, the part of devotion, the part of feeling kindness, respect, compassion towards ourselves and also towards others. And I'd like this evening, I like to look a little bit more into how we can develop that in our practice and also in all day life, everyday life. So practicing, I mean, most of you, I'm sure, because most of you are long-time practitioners, you know how to use metta practice in different ways, and it is an incredible helpful tool just really to get to bring the heart into practice, to bring empathy and also very important well-being into your practice. Like, when you look at where you are in your practice, ask yourself the question, how well do I feel? How much joy is there in my life? How much empathy for others is there? These are indicators how well our practice is going, and a very important part. And when I look back at my first years, I, after about, say, 7 years of practice, I really came to a place that felt like a desert plateau. Like, yes, mindfulness was there, awareness was there, but it felt I felt like there was no nourishment coming in anymore. And I didn't do much metta practice. I remember in my very first years, I think it was 1 or 2 years as an anagaika or so, Ajahn Sumedho actually did do a week of metta practice at Amaravati. And everybody liked it very much, except me. What happened for me at that time was that the first few days worked very well, and then a place opened up where I just felt aversion. Like any more metta just brought up more aversion in my mind. And I still don't understand why that happened, but it was probably, or I probably did not use it in the right way. And also, like at that time, I think my understanding of metta was sweet and nice and like pink cloud in the sky and happy, happy, pleasure, fine, great. But if you do that for a few days, you get fed up with yourself. And I definitely did at that time. So I couldn't hear any word of metta anymore. And then for a long time, I really didn't practice it because I just felt again this aversion coming up. So when we look at metta, when we are practicing metta, we have to understand that it is a way of bringing our heart into this present moment. A lot, for me, metta has a lot to do with acceptance, with care, with the feeling of well-being arising out of the openness of heart. Like as if you open the door of your heart and walk through into the present moment. That means whatever occurs actually is able to touch you, is able to be present as part of this experience. Sometimes, and I think it was yesterday or today in one of the interviews, I was talking to somebody who was experiencing a lot of jealousy coming up. And what I said to the person was, you have to hold that emotion with kindness, with metta. This is like, and this is what I mean by metta practice. It's not only creating, as we did directly this afternoon in the practice, really developing that sense of well-being. But when metta practice works, it also comes into when times get difficult, when strong and difficult emotions come up. We actually can bring this experience of acceptance, of openness of heart into the inquiry. Like when we look at a difficult emotion, like say anger or jealousy, if we look at it in a field of kindness, in a field of acceptance, then it can be there without ourselves attaching to it, without getting lost in the story of it. So when practicing metta in that way, you are providing an extra tool that is supporting mindfulness to do its work. It's like we are creating a field of easefulness around a difficult experience. And that is possible. those emotions with an open heart, with that amount of kindness. Actually, that is what is necessary in order to be able to hold the feeling, in order not getting lost into the feeling, into that particular emotion. It can be jealousy, as mentioned. It can be frustration, fear, sadness, grief. It can be anything. But if we know how to develop the skill of bringing metta practice and practice of acceptance into that, we are actually able to endure the unpleasantness, sometimes the emotional pain or the excruciating pain that can come, like when we do experience a lot of grief. And relating with metta, with acceptance, with care, with understanding towards this emotion, it helps us to fully investigate. If we don't have that tool in place, it will be very difficult to walk fully into those places of pain. And I have been working myself in that way with difficult emotions, and it helps me to really go to the core of it. If I don't have enough metta, if I don't have enough, also if I don't have enough sati, understanding and mindfulness in place, then easily we can move into the storyline of a certain emotional experience. And it's not about repeating the story in our mind, but it is about getting in contact with the unpleasantness, with the painfulness, with the also like with the deeper sense of that experience. Of like in retreats like this, you might experience places opening up that carry a memory from years and years ago. This is naturally to happen. And usually these places only open up when there is a certain amount of safety, a certain amount of well-being there, because otherwise we won't be able to work with it. And so don't be surprised if you experience something like that in a retreat. Like you start off with your practice, two people actually, I think, in one of the interviews mentioned that. Like they are starting off the first 2-3 days, the practice goes really very well. Pleasure, blissful moments, good concentration, and suddenly it changes. Suddenly something opens up, and whether it is conscious or unconscious, and the whole field of experience is changing. Whether you might experience a lot of drowsiness and sleepiness, or you might experience a lot of restlessness of mind. If you are lucky, you can, like, this opening is conscious and you can directly see what is happening, like what old karmic residues are coming onto the surface, into existence, onto the surface back. And you can work by investigating, but also by bringing mindfulness and compassion and metta into that. Like using metta, loving kindness practice, you know, in everyday life means we are making space for receiving not only ourselves but also others. Like on retreats, we are looking inside, so we are not so much concerned with where others are and what they experience. So the main the main focus is inside. But in our everyday lives, we are confronted in situations with others, with ourselves in relation to others, where the practice of kindness, of care, of relating with an open heart can be very crucial, can be very important. And again, it is something we often forget. And so my experience in Sangha life is when I can receive the other person. One thing is that directly I'm giving. It's an act of generosity. And it is also an act of kindness. It is actually enabling connection to happen. If I'm not really open, if I'm not really there and receive and accept the other person where he or she is, I actually can't really receive them. I can't really connect with them. So it's a real important tool. At that point, compassion and loving kindness come very close together, because relating with empathy is a kind act, is an act out of respect, and it's also an act of compassion. Putting myself into the situation of somebody else, or in our practice in the retreat, relating with empathy to what is happening and what is unfolding in the mind. And when looking at compassion, what came up the other day for me was something that I experienced in India last year. And it was a really, like, I don't know if you have that expression in English, but in Germany we say an aha experience. It's like, oh, this is what it is. And what happened was, like, for those of you who have been in India before, you know that the dogs are very much part of life in India, and especially in the night. In the day, I mean, before I went the first time to India, people were warning me of the dangerous dogs. And during the day, I saw them lying around in heaps, sleeping. So I couldn't quite understand why they were so dangerous, because they seemed to be absolutely harmless. And then and then I gathered that actually these dogs, like, come together at night in packs. Like, I think you say a pack of dogs. And, like, they are really making very clear where their territory is, where their boundaries are. And so you can experience nights with almost the whole night dog barking. Like, one pack barking at the other one. Or one dog barking at another dog entering the territory. So at that time, I was in Himachal Pradesh, which is in the foothills of the Himalaya, and I was staying in a monastery, in a Tibetan monastery there, and I was in the guest house. And for those of you who know Himachal, it's quite hilly, and there are quite high mountains also. So this monastery was placed on different hills, and they were very small but quite deep, almost valleys, in between the different buildings of the monastery. So one night the dog barking started and it didn't end. It was in the middle of the night, and then after about an hour or something like that, they started to quieten down, except the dog who lived at the guest house where I stayed. So this dog continued to bark, and slowly all the other dogs quietened down, and this dog continued to bark. And I said, "What's going on here?" And I listened closer, and the dog was barking in response to its own echo. And in the beginning I said, "Well, this dog is so stupid. How come it doesn't understand? It's just its own voice." And then after maybe half an hour or so, the dog started to get more tired, like my voice now. It kind of got more quiet, or it got, like there was sometimes when it barked, there was a question mark in that. And then the echo returned, and there was again the same thing. And more, I could just really hear it. More and more, the dog started to understand what was happening. But it took a long time. I definitely couldn't sleep because it was directly under my window. And I said, why is a dog so stupid? How come it doesn't hear its own voice is responding? And then I said, wait a minute, this sounds familiar. There is something to understand here. This is a teaching in the middle of the night, but anyway, I was awake. So, why I mention that in together with compassion is we can so easily repeat patterns. And in the beginning, we repeat and we repeat and we don't even notice. We just repeat another pattern, or we just repeat the same pattern again. When we see that, it's easily to go into, "Oh my God, here am I go again," or, "Oh my Buddha, here am I going again." And when we do that, what we actually do is we put something else, another judgment, another criticism, on top of the first one. So instead of doing that, stop doing it. Maybe compassion is needed here. Maybe empathy and understanding, and also an open heart who allows us to make mistakes at certain times, not to see really clearly what is needed. What kind of tool do we need to apply? And with compassion, when we develop compassion towards our own shortcomings, we actually can also do it for others. And again, like with metta practice, when we can practice compassion fully, full-heartedly towards ourselves, when we have seen ourselves in situation where we failed, where we made mistakes, we can allow others to do that too without getting in too much judgment in the beginning, and later probably without even needing to judge them. And I think this is crucial. If we miss out on that, we actually miss out on an important part of our practice. I also like to look a little bit at least at the other two divine abidings or limitless abidings, which is mudita, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. What I mentioned before was the emotion of jealousy. Mudita is the absolute opposite of jealousy. It's the antidote to jealousy. It's that what nourishes us and also somebody else. But I think mudita is more something that is actually nourishing ourselves. Like when we can fully enjoy the well-being, the fortune, the even the gain or the being important of somebody else, we develop a quality that has such a deep sense of joy that is even stronger than being in the place of the other person. Like being the one who is successful, being the one that has the sense of well-being, being the one that gets what you want, then yes, that's great. It's wonderful. But in contradiction, the difference to mudita, to sympathetic joy, is that the quality of that kind of joy, of that kind of connection, is limitless. It has no boundaries. And it can open our hearts to such an amount of joy that we would not encounter when we are receiving something directly. And also it gives us the opportunity to join in with the joy and the well-being of the whole universe, of every being. And it's something that should not be underestimated. And it goes very much together with the quality of metta, of kindness, respect, and also with compassion. But, I mean, compassion is not so much part of being joyful about the well-being or the wellness of somebody else. So when we do experience jealousy, we notice the absence of mudita. So usually we can't go straight from jealousy into mudita, of course. Otherwise the jealousy wouldn't be there. So what is needed here is you have to look deeper. What is the cause of this jealousy? What is that part inside yourself that is needy, that needs care, that needs attention, that maybe needs love, maybe that needs being noticed? And as I said before, really accepting it to be there, not turning towards this with a judgmental mind, knowing, this is there, this is in place, this is what is unfolding right now. And maybe you, when you look at that, you might experience a memory coming up from an experience before. Maybe not. But if that is the case, then just take that into account and notice, here again a pattern is unfolding. Something is repeating itself because in the first place it didn't get the amount of love or empathy or care that was needed. When I spoke yesterday with the person who mentioned experiencing jealousy, she said to me, how can I get... Oh no, I don't want to feel jealousy. I want to be equanimous. And I can very much understand that. When we are in the place of jealousy, we want to be anything else than that, because it just feels utterly awful. And also, like, when we look at jealousy, actually what it does is we do want to diminish, or we don't want to accept the well-being of somebody else. And that's pretty awful. And just feeling that is very unpleasant. So, of course, the first impulse is, I want to get out of here. I don't want to feel it. So put equanimity in place. But in fact, this is not what equanimity is about. Equanimity is a place of balance, is a place in between extremes. It's a place of peacefulness of mind, evenness of mind. And this, you might have experiences in your practice when the practice really works well. Then there is no preference. There's no preference for pleasant states of mind, and there's no rejection of painful places of mind. You can have equanimity with pain, but equanimity can only be there when you fully have accepted it. Then equanimity can come into its place. And so developing equanimity is very important, and we can do that when we experience calm states of mind. Because at that point, the disturbing emotions or difficult emotions, or you could also say the hindrances, are not in place. If they are not in place, we can develop equanimity, because at that time, the mind is balanced completely, at, you could also say, like, completely in between wanting and not wanting, being free from any of these tendencies, any of these extremes. Staying in that point of equanimity needs quite a bit of development, but is very important for not just for our practice, but also in everyday life, because we are so much exposed to what we call the worldly winds of pleasure and pain, of disrepute and being famous, and between, I don't have the other four now, can somebody help me? Yeah, loss and gain, exactly. And so, like, really noticing when those tendencies come up, noticing, like, when there is loss, the immediate impulse into going into grief or going into frustration. With practicing equanimity, we can see before we actually get lost in these emotions that go with the worldly experience. Can we just stay at that point that is still quiet? Mindfulness is very helpful for using, like, mindfulness practice, and the practice of being present with what is unfolding comes in here. But at the same time, also the other qualities of understanding, of compassion, of metta. So all these things have to be in place in order for developing equanimity. Equanimity is kind of, when you look at these four divine abidings, it's almost like the peak of that practice. When you have put all the other practices quite well in place, equanimity comes naturally in. So, on the whole, I really want to encourage you for the rest of the time here to bring in the quality of heart into your practice. Of course, we do have the chanting practice, and for some of us, this is an enormous resource of devotion and of heart. For some of us, not so much. Like, I'm actually suffering quite sometimes with the chanting, because just my voice at the moment doesn't work very well, and then it's hard really to focus on the beauty of it all. But find ways of nourishing the heart, and when you feel like you start to become a vipassana computer. I mean, it's a bit extreme, but yeah, it's kind of sati in place, beep, beep, and sati sampajanya, beep, beep, yes, all there. So when you start this kind of reaction, or when you see these kind of reactions coming up, be careful. The heart is missing. And the nourishment is missing. It's very important. I like to offer this for your reflection tonight. I just realized, before we do the last chanting, I was writing something down this evening. I have a very good reminder for nourishment, like heart nourishment, in my room. It's a calligraphy which says, "Be alive." And there are many things written on it, and I have just copied a few of it. So, and I think it probably was made by one of the Christian nuns living here. I'm not sure, but it looks very much like that. And it is written in rainbow letters. And this "be alive" is going, it's quite big, it's about that size. And this "be alive" is in very big letters, and in between are the other things that I'm reading out now. Think freely. Practice patience. Smile often. Make new friends. Rediscover old ones. Tell those you love that you do. Feel deeply. Forgive. Grow. Be crazy. Not too much. Count your blessings. Observe miracles. Make them happen. Discard worry. Give and give in. Trust enough to take. Trust life. Have faith. Enjoy. Wonder. Comfort a friend. Have good ideas. make some mistakes and learn from them. Explore the unknown. From time to time I look at this calligraphy and just take it in again. I find it very beautiful, just really heartening, touching the heart.